He did not use soap or water, of course. He just made a few strokes with the razor blade across a piece of stone, and then grabbing my temples firmly with his left hand, he began the painful process of scraping off the stubble from my skull. None of us liked this process, and we all expected to end up with a bloody head, with a head nicked, chopped, and gashed. However, Tibetans are not soft, they do not run screaming at the first trace of pain. So I sat there while the monk barber scraped and scraped away. "I suppose I'd better trim your neck, eh?" he said. "Understand your guide man has returned, you'll be wanting to rush off, eh?" With that he shoved my head down almost between my knees, and then scraped industriously at the long hair where my head joined my neck. All the time he kept blowing at me, blowing off the hair which he had cut, and each time, if I guessed the right time, I held my breath because his breath was, well, not pleasant. Apparently his teeth were rotting or something. At last, though, he finished his scraping and we started to mop up the blood from the numerous scratches. Someone said, "Quickest way to stop it is to put a piece of paper on each scratch. Let's try it." So I ended looking something like a scarecrow with little three-cornered bits of paper stuck to bloody patches. I had nothing better to do for a time, so I stayed in the barber monk's room and listened to all the conversation. It seemed that matters were in a very bad state in the Western world. It seemed that the world was just about aflame. There seemed to be trouble in Russia, trouble in England, the Irish people were making a commotion, only we of Tibet were peaceful. I fell silent as I recalled the prophecies which had been made about Tibet centuries before, and I knew that in our time, in my lifetime in fact, we of Tibet would have our own troubles. I knew also that our own beloved Dalai Lama would be the last actual Dalai Lama, and although there would be one more, he would not be of the same spiritual significance. Idly I turned over a page and saw a most extraordinary picture. It seemed to consist of a lot of boxes with pieces cut out of the sides, and out of the sides people's faces were peering. The boxes were all joined together, and they seemed to be drawn along by some monster which was belching smoke. There were circular things beneath the boxes, and there seemed to be two lines between them. I could not at all make out the significance of what it was. I did not at that time know that they were wheels, and what I was seeing was a train, because in Tibet the only wheels were prayer wheels. I turned to the English reading monk and tugged at his robe. Eventually he turned to me, and I asked him to tell me what it said. He translated for me that it was a British troop train taking soldiers to fight in the fields of Flanders. Another picture fascinated me and thrilled me beyond all explanation. It was of a contraption that appeared to be a kite with no string keeping it in touch with the ground. This kite seemed to be a framework covered with cloth, and in the front of it there seemed to be a thing which, by the representation of the picture, must have been revolving, and I saw there were two people in this kite, one in the front and one sitting close behind. The quite friendly English reading monk told me that it was an airplane, a thing that I had never heard of before. I resolved that if I were ever expelled from the Lamasery, or from the order, I would not be a boatman, but I would instead be one of those people who flew those strange kites which they had in the West. And then, as I turned those pages, I saw another thing, a thing which frightened me speechless for a time, and that was a feat in itself, for this thing appeared to be a long tube covered with cloth or some sort of material, and it was shown as if flying above a city and dropping great black things on the city. Other pictures showed the black things landing, and showed a flash and damage as buildings flew up in the air. The monk told me that it was a thing called a zeppelin which was used to bomb England, and that a bomb was a metal canister filled with high explosive which blew everything from its path when it landed. It seemed to me that these magazines had nothing of peace in them, they were, instead, dealing only with war. I thought that I had looked enough at those pictures which merely served to inflame men's angry passions, and so I put down the magazines, made my thanks to the English reading monk and to the barber monk, and made my way upwards again to the dormitory where I knew I could soon expect a messenger. The endless day drew on. Once again it was time for Tsampa. I went down into the hall and had my meal with the others, but I confess the day was endless, endless. I had little appetite, but I thought I should take an advantage and eat while there was still time. Having cleaned my bowl, I left the dining hall, made my way up again to the dormitory, and stood for a time looking out of the window, watching the bustle that surrounded our buildings. Chapter 10. Soon there came to our corridor boy yelling, "Lobsang! Lobsang!" I hastened across the room and met him at the door as he was about to enter. "Phew!" he exclaimed, wiping imaginary perspiration from his brow. "I've looked everywhere for you. Been in hiding or something? Your guide wants you." "What does he look like?" I asked, in some anxiety. "Look like? Look like? What do you expect him to look like? You saw him just a few days ago. What's wrong with you, anyhow? Sick or something?" The boy wandered off muttering about stupid. I turned away and pulled my robe straight and felt to be sure that my bowl and charm box was in place. Then I walked up the corridor. It was a pleasure to leave the boys' quarters, with the smeared lime-washed walls, and enter the much more ornate lama's quarters. As I wandered softly along, I could see into most of the rooms I passed. Most of the lamas kept their doors open. Here an old man was fingering his beads and reciting endlessly, "Om Mani Padme Hum." Another was reverently turning the pages of some old book, looking unceasingly for yet another meaning from the scriptures. It rather bothered me to see these old men trying to read between the lines, trying to read into writing those messages which were not put there in the first place. Then they would burst out with a new interpretation of the scriptures, by Lama so and so. A very ancient man, with a straggly white beard, was gently twirling a prayer wheel and crooning to himself as he did so. Yet another was declaiming to himself, practicing for a forthcoming theological debate in which he was to take a leading part. "Now don't you come here bringing dirt to my clean floor, you young squirt," said a testy old cleaning monk as he leaned on his brush and eyed me balefully. "I don't work here all day for the likes of you. Go and jump out of the window, old one," I said rudely as I walked past him. He stretched out and tried to grab me, but, tripping over his long brush handle, fell to the floor with a resounding thud. I hastened my steps so as to have a head start before he could climb to his feet. No one took any notice. Prayer wheels still hummed and clacked, the declaimer still declaimed, and voices still intoned their mantras. In some near room an old man was hawking and clearing his throat with horrid noises. "Ruck! Ruck! Ah!" he went in his endless attempt to obtain relief. I walked on. These corridors were long, and I had to walk from the quarters of the lowest form of lamastic life to almost the highest, to that of the very senior lamas. Now, as I progressed towards the better area, more and more doors were shut. At last I turned off the main corridor and entered a small annex, the domain of the special ones. Here, in the place of honor, my guide resided when at the Potala. With a rapidly beating heart I stopped at a door and knocked. "Come in," said a well-loved voice. I entered and made my ritual bows to the shining personage sitting with his back to the window. The Lama Minyadon up smiled kindly at me and very carefully looked at me to see how I had fared during the past 7 or so days. "Sit down, Lobsang, sit down," he said, pointing to a cushion placed before him. For some time we sat while he asked me questions, most difficult to answer, some of them were, too. This great man filled me with the deepest feelings of love and devotion. I wanted nothing more than to be continually in his presence. "The inmost one is very pleased with you," he remarked, adding idly, "and I suppose that calls for some sort of celebration." He stretched out his hand and tinkled his small silver bell. A serving monk entered and brought a low table, one of those ornate things carved and with many coats of color. I was always afraid of scratching or marking the wretched things. The table was placed to the right of my guide. Smiling at me, the Lama turned to the serving monk and said, "You have the plain table ready for Lobsang?"
"Yes, master," the man replied. "I will fetch it now." He left, soon returning with a very plain table which had the best ornaments of all. It was laden with things from India. Sweet and sticky cakes which were covered with some sort of syrup which had then been sprinkled with sugar, pickled walnuts, special chestnuts which had been brought from a far, far country, and many other items which delighted my heart. The serving monk smiled slightly as he also put beside me a large jar of the herbs which we used when afflicted with indigestion. Another serving monk entered bearing small cups and a large jug full of steaming Indian tea. At a sign from my guide they withdrew, and I had a pleasant change from Tsampa. I did not bother to think about the other acolytes who probably never in their lives had tasted anything except Tsampa. I knew quite well that probably Tsampa would be their only food for as long as they lived, and I consoled myself with the thought that if they suddenly had a taste of these exotic foods from India, it would make them dissatisfied. I knew that I was going to have a hard time in life, I knew that soon there would be very different foods for me, so in my small boy smug complacency I thought there was nothing wrong in having a foretaste of pleasant things to compensate for the unpleasant things which I had already endured. So I ate more than I should with complete tranquility. My guide remained silent, and all he had was tea, the Indian variety. But eventually, with a sigh of the utmost regret, I decided that I could not take even another crumb. In fact, the mere sight of that wretched food was beginning to appear distasteful to me, it was coloring my outlook, and I felt, well, as if enemies were fighting inside me. I became aware that certain unwanted specks were floating before my eyes, so I had no more to eat, and before long I had to withdraw to another place, for the food had stretched my stomach rather painfully. When I returned, somewhat paler, considerably lighter, and a little shaken, my guide was still sitting, still unruffled, quite benign. He smiled at me as I settled myself again, saying, "Well, now you have had and lost most of your tea, you at least have the memory of it, and that might help you. We will talk about various things." I settled myself very comfortably. His eyes were roaming, no doubt wondering how my injuries were, then he told me, "I had a talk with the inmost one who told me of your, flying on to the golden roof. His Holiness told me all about it, told me what he had seen, and told me that you risked expulsion to tell him the truth. He is very pleased with you, very pleased with the reports he has had about you, very pleased with what he has seen, for he was watching you when you were looking for me, and now I have special orders about you." The Lama looked at me, smiling slightly, possibly amused at the expression which I knew was on my face. More trouble, I thought, more tales of woe to come, more hardships to endure now so that they won't appear so bad in the future by comparison. I am sick of hardship, I thought to myself. Why can't I be like some of those people who flew those kites in a battle, or drove those roaring steam boxes with a lot of soldiers? I thought. Two, I would rather like to be in charge of one of those metal things which floated on water and took a lot of people between countries. Then my attention wandered, and I pondered the question, how could they be metal? Anyone would know that metal was heavier than water and so would sink. There must be a catch to it, I decided, they could not be metal at all, that monk must have been telling me a story. I looked up to see my guide laughing at me. He had been following my thoughts by telepathy, and he really was amused. Those kites are aeroplanes, the steam dragon is a train, and those iron boxes are ships, and, yes, iron ships really do float. I will tell you all about it later, but for the moment we have other things in mind. He rang his bell again, and a serving monk entered and removed the table which had been before me, smiling ruefully at all the havoc I had made of the foods from India. My guide said we wanted more tea, and we waited while a fresh lot was brought to us. "I prefer Indian tea to China tea," said my guide. I agreed with him, China tea always rather sickened me, I did not know why because I was obviously more used to China tea, but the Indian tea seemed to be more pleasant. Our discussion on the matter of tea was interrupted by the serving monk bringing in the fresh supply. He withdrew as my guide poured fresh cups of tea. "His Holiness has said that you be withdrawn from the ordinary standard classes. Instead, you are to move into an apartment next to mine, and you are to be taught by me and by the leading Lama specialists. You have the task of preserving much of the ancient knowledge, and later you will have to put much of that knowledge into writing, for our most alert seers have forecast the future of our country, saying that we shall be invaded, and much that is in this Lamassery and others will be ravaged and destroyed. Through the wisdom of the inmost one, certain records are already being copied so that the copies will remain here to be destroyed and the originals will be taken far, far away where no invader will be able to reach. First, you will have to be taught extensively about the metaphysical arts. He stopped speaking and rose to his feet, and moved into another room. I heard him rustling about, and then he came back carrying a very plain wooden box which he brought and placed on the ornamental table. He sat down before me and for a moment or two remained silent. Years and years ago people were very different from what they are now. Years and years ago people could call upon their natural laws and use senses which humanity has now lost except in certain rare instances. Many hundreds of centuries ago people were telepathic and clairvoyant, but through using such powers for evil purposes humans as a whole have lost the ability. The whole of those powers now are atrophied. Worse, humans now generally deny the existence of such powers. You will find when you move about to different countries that when you leave Tibet and India, it will not be wise to talk of clairvoyance, astral traveling, levitation, or telepathy, because people will merely say, "Prove it, prove it, you talk in riddles, you talk nonsense, there is no such thing as this, or that, or something else, if there were science would have discovered it." He withdrew into himself for a moment, and a shadow crossed his features. He had traveled extensively, and although he looked young, well, actually he looked ageless, one could not say if he were an old man or a young man. His flesh was firm and his face fairly unlined, he radiated health and vitality, yet I knew that he had traveled to faraway Europe, traveled to Japan, China, and India. I knew, too, that he had had some most amazing experiences. Sometimes when he was sitting he would look at some magazine which had been brought over the mountains from India, and then he would sigh with sorrow at the folly of warring mankind. There was one particular magazine which really interested him, and whenever he could he had it brought from India. It was a peculiar sort of magazine called London Illustrated. I found odd copies of the magazine to be a great source of information, giving me pictures about things quite beyond my understanding. I was interested in what were called advertisements, and whenever I could I tried to read the pictures and then, as opportunity presented itself, I would find someone who knew enough of the strange language to tell me about the wording. I sat and looked at my guide. Occasionally I looked at the wooden box which he had brought out, and wondered what it could possibly contain. It was a box of some wood quite foreign to me. It had eight sides to it so that, as near as anything, it was round. I sat for some time wondering what it was all about, what was in it, why he had suddenly lapsed into silence. Then he spoke, "Lobsang, you have to develop your very high degree of natural clairvoyance to an even higher state, and the first thing is to get to know this." Briefly he motioned to the eight-sided wooden box as if that would explain everything, but it just led me into a deeper state of confusion. "I have here a present which is given to you by order of the Inmost One himself. It is given to you to use and with it you can do much good." He leaned forward and with two hands picked up the wooden box, and looked at it for a few moments before putting it in my hands. He put it very carefully in my hands and held his own hands nearby in case I, boy-like, should be clumsy and drop it. It was a surprising weight, and I thought it must have a lump of stone inside it to be so heavy. "Open it, Lobsang," said the Lama Miniadondup. "You will not get any information about it by just looking at the box." Dumbly I turned the thing in my hands, hardly knowing how to open it because it was eight-sided and I could not see how the top fitted on. But then I grasped the top and somehow gave it a half-twist. The top dome portion came off in my hands. I peered at it and it was just a lid, so I put it down beside me while I devoted my attention to what was in the box. All I could see was a lump of cloth, so I grasped that and went to lift it out, but the weight was quite amazing. I spread my robe carefully so that if there was anything loose inside it would not fall on the floor, and then with my hands over the box I inverted the box and took the weight of the contents on my fingers. I put down the now empty box and devoted my attention to the spherical object wrapped up in dead black cloth. As my busy fingers unwrapped the thing, I gasped in fascinated awe, for revealed to me now was a very wonderful, quite flawless crystal. It was indeed crystal, not like the glass used by fortune tellers, but this crystal was so pure that one could hardly see where it began and ended. It was almost like a sphere of nothingness as I held it in my hands, that is, until I contemplated the weight, and the weight was quite formidable. It weighed as much as a stone of the same size would weigh. My guide looked at me smilingly. As I met his eyes, he said, "You have the right touch, Lobsang, you are holding it in the correct manner. Now you will have to wash it before you can use it, and you will have to wash your hands, too." He exclaimed. "Wash it, Honorable Lama?" I said in some amazement. "Whatever should I wash it for? It is perfectly clear, perfectly clean." "Yes, but it is necessary that any crystal be washed when it changes hands, because that crystal has been handled by me, and then the inmost one handled it, and I handled it after. So. Now, you do not want to delve into my past or my future, and it is, of course, forbidden to delve into the past, present, or future of the inmost one. Therefore go into the other room," he motioned with his hand to the direction I should take, "and wash your hands, then wash the crystal, and make sure that you pour water over it so that it be running water. I will wait here until you have finished." Very carefully I wrapped up the crystal and eased myself off the cushion where I had been sitting, placing the crystal on its center so that it could not fall off onto the ground. When I had regained my feet and was standing more or less securely, I reached and lifted the cloth-wrapped bundle and left the room. It was a beautiful thing to hold in water. As I rubbed my hands around it under the water, it seemed to glow with life. It felt as if it were part of me, it felt as if it belonged to me, as indeed it now did. I gently set it aside and washed my own hands, making sure that I used plenty of fine sand, and then I rinsed them and went back and rewashed the crystal, holding it beneath the jug which I held inverted while the water splashed over the crystal, making a little rainbow as the falling drops were struck by the incoming sunlight. With the crystal clean, and my hands clean too, I returned to the room of my guide, the Lama Minya Dondup. "You and I are going to be much closer in the future. We are going to live next door to each other, for so the inmost one has decreed. You are not to sleep in the dormitory after this night. Arrangements are being made whereby when we return to Chakpurai tomorrow, you will have a room next to mine. You will study with me, and you will study with learned lamas who have seen much, done much, and traveled in the astral. You will also keep your crystal in your room, and no one else must touch it because it would give a different influence to it. Now move your cushion and sit with your back to the light." I shuffled round and sat with my back to the light. I sat rather close to the window, carefully clutching the crystal in my hands, but my guide was not satisfied. "No, no, be sure that no ray of light falls on the crystal, for if it does you will make false reflections within. It is necessary that there be no points of light in the crystal, instead you must be aware of it, but not aware of its exact circumference." He rose to his feet, and pulled an oil silk curtain over the window, subduing the sunlight, and making the room flood with a pale blue glow, almost as if twilight had come upon us. It should be said that we had very little glass in Lhasa, or rather, very little glass in Tibet, because all glass had to be brought across the mountains on the backs of traders or on the backs of their pack animals, and in the sudden storms which beset our city, glass would be shattered immediately by the wind-driven stones. Thus, we had shutters made of different material. Some were of wood and others were of oil silk or similar, which shut out the wind and shut out the dust. But the oil silk was the best because it let sunlight filter through. At last I was in a position which my guide considered to be suitable. I was sitting with my legs tucked under me, not in the lotus position because my legs had been too much damaged for that, but I was sitting with my legs tucked under me and my feet were protruding to the right. In my lap my cupped hands held the crystal, held it beneath so that I could not see my hands under the bulging sides of that globe. My head was bowed, and I had to look at the crystal or in the crystal without actually seeing, without actually focusing. Instead, to see correctly in a crystal, one focused at a point in infinity, because if one focused directly at the crystal, one focuses automatically on any smear, or speck of dust, or on any reflection, and that usually destroys the effect. So, I was taught to always focus at some point in infinity while apparently looking through the crystal. I was reminded of my experience in the temple when I had seen the wandering souls come in range, and where the nine lamas had been doing their chant, punctuating each reference to a stick of incense by the tinkling of a silver bell. My guide smiled across at me, and said, "Now there is no time to do any crystal gazing or scrying for the moment, because you will be taught properly, and this is a case of more haste less speed. You want to learn how to hold the thing properly, as indeed you are doing now, but you want to learn the different methods of holding for different occasions. If you want world affairs, you use the crystal on a stand, or if you want to read about one individual, you take the crystal and let the inquirer hold it first, after which you take it from him and, if you are properly trained, you can see that which he wants to know." Just at that moment pandemonium broke out above us. There was the deep, roaring, discordant sound of the conches like yaks lowing in the meadows, the ululating sound which wobbled up and down the scale like an excessively fat monk trying to waddle along. I could never discern any music in the conches, others could, and they told me it was because I was tone deaf. After the conches came the blare of the temple trumpets, and the ringing of bells, and the beating on the wooden drums. My guide turned to me and said, "Well, Lobsang, you and I had better go to the service, because the inmost one will be there, and it is common courtesy for us to go on our last evening here at the Potala. I must hurry off, you come at your own speed." So saying, he rose to his feet, gave me a pat on the shoulder and hurried out. Very carefully I wrapped up my crystal, wrapped it very, very carefully indeed, and then with the utmost caution I put it back in its eight-sided wooden box. I put it on the table by the seat of my guide the Lama Minyadond up. And then I, too, followed down the corridor. Acolytes, monks, and lamas were hurrying along from all directions. It reminded me of a disturbed colony of ants rushing along. People seemed to be in a hurry so that they could get in the best position relative to their own class. I was in no hurry so long as I got in somewhere and could sit without being seen, that was all I asked. The sound of the conches ceased. The blaring of the trumpets ended. By now the stream entering the temple had diminished to a trickle and I found myself following at the tail end. This was the great temple, the temple at which attended the inmost one himself when he had time from his world duties to come and mix with the lamas. The great pillars supporting the roof seemed to soar up into the blackness of night. Above us there were the ever-present clouds of incense smoke, greys, and blues, and whites, swirling and intermingling and yet never seeming to settle out into one particular shade, for all these clouds of incense seemed in some way to retain their own individuality. Small boys were rushing around with flaring torches lighting more and more butter lamps, which sputtered and hissed, and then burst into flames. Here and there, there was a lamp which had not been properly lighted because one had first to rather melt the butter so that it became liquid like oil, otherwise the wick which should be floating merely charred and smoldered, and made us sneeze with the smoke. At last sufficient lamps were lit, and huge sticks of incense were brought out and they, too, were lit, and then extinguished so that they glowed red and gave out great clouds of smoke. As I looked about me I saw all the lamas in one group in rows facing each other, and the next row would be back to back, and so on facing each other, and the next row would be back to back. Farther out from them were the monks sitting in a similar manner, and beyond those the acolytes. The lamas had little tables about a foot high on which reposed various small items, including the ever-present silver bell, some had wooden drums, and later as the service started the lector standing at his lectern would read out passages from our sacred books, and the lamas and the monks in unison would chant, and the lamas would, at the completion of each passage, ring their bells, while others would tap with their fingers on the drums. Again and again, to signify the end of some particular part of the service, There would be the rumbling of the conches from somewhere in the distance, somewhere in the dim recesses of the temple. I looked on, but it was merely a spectacle to me, it was merely religious discipline, and I decided at some time when I had time I would ask my guide why it was necessary to go through this ceremony.